astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson says he doesn't have to make science cool. It already is.
I think the universe is inherently cool, and I'm just revealing that to you. That's all I'm doing. Black holes are cool. The thermonuclear fusion in the core of the sun is cool. Asteroid impacts are cool. Time travel is cool.
He joins us to talk about his new book, Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. Plus, a veterinary clinic in Urbana has been receiving an overwhelming number of baby bunnies.
People find them in their backyard, and their first thought is, oh, well, it must be orphaned. So they think it's in danger, and that's usually how they end up coming to us.
We'll learn how to tell if a baby animal is in danger or if it should be simply left alone. But first, we check in with Congresswoman Sherry Bustos and bring you the latest in Illinois politics. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next.
Thank you.
Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, live from the Medill Newsroom in downtown Chicago, and a special good morning to all the folks who are listening today from Northern Public Radio. Welcome to Kalb and Rockford. We're happy to have you. In a few minutes, we're going to be bringing you the latest in Illinois politics with Sarah Burnett and Dave McKinney, as we like to do on Mondays. But first, on Friday afternoon, I caught up with Congresswoman Sherry Bustos. She represents Illinois' 17th district, which includes parts of Rockford, Peoria, and the Quad Cities. Thanks for being with us, Representative.
Well, thank you.
You and Senator Durbin have just announced some money for defense jobs in Illinois, including more than $110 million for Humvee manufacturing in Rock Island. And I wonder, I don't think money for defense is going to be a tough ask with the Trump administration, given the priorities they've laid out. But what about other key manufacturing and infrastructure jobs for Illinois in this budget cycle?
Well, manufacturing is still the foundation of the state of Illinois, the industrial heartland, and certainly in my district. Ag is still a major, agriculture is still the number one economic driver for the state of Illinois, but there's all kinds of manufacturing that plays into that as well. I feel pretty fortunate that the committees I serve on are agriculture and also transportation and infrastructure, which I have high hopes that we can work together, Democrats and Republicans, and pass a meaningful transportation bill that will put people back to work and will address our crumbling infrastructure. But as it pertains to manufacturing, why I do so many of my Sherry on shifts and job shadowing in manufacturing is because those are jobs that still pay well, where people can support their families. And so we have, Democrats have a whole package of legislation. There's, I have 40 plus bills in this that we call it the Make It in America package. And it, most of that is around manufacturing. I have a bill in there that is called the Boosting America's Export Act. And all that is strategically placing export assistance centers, especially around smaller towns or mid-sized towns, to work with small and mid-sized manufacturers to help them find new markets for what they're making. And then help those small and mid-sized businesses, you know, that aren't like a company like Caterpillar or John Deere, that have people sitting around the table who can identify countries where they can export and can work out all that paperwork. But there are so many new opportunities for the great products that we make in Illinois and in the Midwest to sell those in other countries. But these small and mid-sized companies need help with that. So that's just one example of how we're trying to help manufacturing grow in our region.
Yeah, given, I mean, as you talk about trade, not just for agriculture, but for manufacturing, I'm thinking about Illinois and its exports and the conversations that have happened in Washington around the Trump administration and furthering restricting different trade regulations. And I wonder what your thoughts are regarding that, how difficult you think it is going to be to promote what you've been talking about.
Well, you know, as you know, you're a Midwesterner. We in the Midwest, the way we do things is, and I think this sizes up the vast majority of people I serve, is, you know, if somebody looks you in the eye and tells you something, we expect them to keep their promise. The reason why a congressional district like mine voted for Donald Trump and he won my congressional district is because he said, I'm going to bring your jobs home, and I'm going to stop these bad trade deals. And, you know, here's a guy who in his own company has his products made in 12 different countries. And here's a guy who has had trouble paying his bills and working with hardworking men and women in the trade unions when he builds all of his projects. So, you know, what I would say to President Trump is you gave your word to the American public that you were going to focus on jobs and the economy and bringing jobs home. And where is your proposal to do that? And in fact, I introduced legislation, the first piece of legislation I introduced in this congressional session, to ask Donald Trump to show us what his plan is for stopping outsourcing jobs, because I want to work with him on that. I stand here with open arms saying, President Trump, let's work together to help our manufacturing economy, and let's help these small and mid-sized manufacturers and big companies like John Deere and Caterpillar. Let's help them. But, you know, President Trump has been so caught up in controversy over, his and his administration's alleged involvement in hurting our democracy through Vladimir Putin, that, we're not focusing on what we need to be focusing on. And, it's time that we do that. And along those lines, President Trump needs to work in a transparent environment so we know exactly if he didn't have any involvement with Putin and Russia and trying to harm our democracy, then, all we need to do is see the evidence for that. So let's get this independent prosecutor and investigation going so we know what the truth is here.
That's Representative Sherry Bustos. She represents Illinois' 17th district in Washington. Representative Bustos, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Tomorrow, we're going to be airing the rest of our conversation with Representative Bustos. We're going to be talking to her about the boot camp she ran earlier this year to encourage more female Democrats to run for office. And we're going to be joined by one of those women who attended that boot camp and just won a seat on Normal's Township Council. As we do on Mondays, we like to catch everybody up on Illinois politics and national politics as well as it involves Illinois. Joining me now to talk about that for the AP, Sarah Burnett from Reuters in Chicago, Dave McKinney. Sarah, Dave, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Dave, let's start. You just heard Congresswoman Bustos share her thoughts on the firing of FBI Director James Comey. I didn't even ask her about it specifically. She went straight there. What are we hearing from the rest of our Washington delegation about Comey? That was a lot of conversation last week we saw, right?
Well, I mean, the Democrats like Bustos are complaining about it. The Republicans are trying to figure out how in the world to respond to it. I mean, there's been a lot of silence. I know Peter Rostom put out a statement last week that noted how Comey was a lightning rod for both parties and that he had lost confidence in the American people. But then there was sort of a line tucked in that statement that said, I was really surprised by the timing. And it seems like Republicans in general are sort of coalescing around the idea, well, this is a shocking move by the president. But they don't seem willing to go to the next step and say that there was something, truly, evil or wrong about it. So they find themselves in a very familiar predicament with this president where they're having to respond to moves that are not coordinated in any way with the congressional leaders. So everybody's kind of doing it, fighting for themselves.
It's a pretty delicate dance, they're making.
Yeah.
Sarah, let me ask you about, let's shift topics entirely and ask you about today, the State Board of Elections is going to decide whether or not to fine Illinois Auditor General Frank Martino. Can you remind us a little bit about this case? He didn't disclose information from his campaign fund, right, when he was a state legislator?
Correct. Well, what happened was after he was selected to be the Auditor General, and keep in mind he had a fair amount of bipartisan support when he was chosen for that job, there was a group downstate that raised some questions about his spending from his campaign fund, and specifically that he had spent close to $250,000 over, I think it was 16 years, at one gas station in Spring Valley, Illinois, and he said it was for car repairs and gas. And, of course, to be paid for out of the campaign fund, it has to be campaign vehicles. It can't be private vehicles. And so they were looking into that and wanting to see a little more detail on that spending, receipts and things like that. What happened is that Martino has acknowledged or told folks that there is actually a parallel federal investigation going on into this. And so he either is not able to provide the records because some of them were destroyed, but the more recent records, he's simply not providing them. So the decision today is simply a decision whether or not to fine him for not providing the information. It doesn't get directly to whether or not he did something wrong with the spending.
Dave, I wonder, I don't know if the irony is the right word for our Auditor General now being investigated for all of this.
Well, irony is a good word. I mean, Illinois, for as long as it's had an Auditor General, I mean, these kinds of controversies have been missing. I mean, in Bill Holland, Martino's predecessor, he too came from a political background. He was a former chief of staff for Senate President Phil Rock, but he managed over the entire tenure as Auditor General to basically be scandal-free. And this has been a very unwelcome cloud hanging over Martino over the duration of his time. I mean, Martino spent a lot of years heading the Legislative Audit Commission, which is the legislative body that you know reviews these audits and such. And so he knows the process really well. But I think that it has, as you point out, it's an irony that you know the chief, I don't know, for lack of a better word, bean counter is having problems counting his beans. I mean, that's the reality here. And the size of that, we all know what a car repair costs. And these expenses occurred after Illinois imposed a prohibition on the personal use of campaign funds. I mean, back in the 90s and earlier, you know, they could have gone, you know, a politician could have spent any amount of money like this on any personal vehicle and no questions be asked. But now that's not the case. And how you rack up that kind of a bill on vehicle expenditures is kind of beyond me.
Let's switch topics again from Auditor General to Attorney General. Lisa Madigan announced she's running for a record fifth term. Sarah, Dave, any surprises there? Are we surprised that she's going to continue to do this? Sarah, what do you think?
I don't think so. I think, a couple years ago, she obviously was out there as a potential candidate for governor to run against Bruce Rauner or to be the Democratic nominee. And there was some question then, and when she said at the time that she wasn't going to do that because she didn't think it was proper as long as her father was the speaker. I mean, we haven't heard her name come up again, you know, this time around like we did back then, specifically because Mike Madigan is still the Speaker of the House. And so, you know, logically, she wouldn't be looking to become governor anyway. It was interesting because it wasn't so much of a big announcement from her. It was just sort of her answering a question like, yes, I'm going
right.
to run again.
Yes, I'm running again. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I guess given, Dave, I wonder if you want to weigh in just on the crowded already field for people who have said they're running against Rauner, if that's probably maybe just part of her just kind of quelling any kind of discussion about it anyway.
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, if she were to consider running for governor, I mean, she would come at this, in spite of her name, with a big disadvantage compared to some of the others in the field already. I mean, she doesn't have, you know, the wealth that a J.B. Pritzker has. Her last name statewide is a bit of an albatross. I mean,
and polling, it's not Kennedy.
Involving her
right.
father. It's not Kennedy, right? Polling for her father statewide. I mean, he's has an approval rating that's, you know, below 30% or thereabouts. So, you know, it's funny, right? I had a guy in Springfield a long time ago tell me that AG, the abbreviation for Attorney General, also meant aspiring governor, because typically it's been it can be used as a springboard for a higher office like that. It's just unusual, and I'm not sure it's great for the party, honestly, to have somebody camping out in an office like this. It's very important for a long period of time because it kind of clogs up the pipeline a little bit for people to try to jump to these higher offices. Madigan has managed to, you know, do this job for as long as she has, scandal-free. And, I don't think that she's not done a bad job by any means, but it's a strange political story in Illinois that, someone who has been around this long, someone who has great intellect and smarts and know-how is sort of stuck in this office. And, I'm not sure what the plan is for her to get out of it.
We just have about a minute left, guys. I just want to ask you quickly about the budget. There's a rally actually at noon today in Chicago called the March to Springfield Kickoff, more than 300 organizations. Sarah, I wonder if you can weigh in quickly about whether we're seeing enough pressure from outside on lawmakers for a budget now that we're approaching the end of the legislative session of May 31st.
Right. So you're referring to the group that's actually going to walk from here to Springfield. Your question, I sort of smile at your question because I was discussing it with my colleagues this morning, and my comment was, you know, bless their hearts for doing it, but I don't think that's going to do the trick. I mean, we have seen so far that, like, basically enormous pressure, and it has little to no effect. So,
yeah, Dave, any yes or no? Like, walk to Springfield,
well,
will it make any difference?
No, I agree. These rallies that I mean, I think they make the participants feel good and feel like they're making a difference. But I've just over the years watched the effect that they tend to have on legislators, and they don't often have that big of an effect. And, you know, to me, the only thing that might get anybody to move, you know, in terms of voting on something is if there's a determination made that you know, as we come into the 2018 election cycle, that some of these sitting lawmakers are going to be held accountable or will have a difficulty in explaining how they weren't also culpable in this budget mess. I mean, so far this battle has been mainly confined to Madigan versus Rauner.
Yeah, well, we'll have to leave it at that, Dave. I'm afraid, yeah, we're out of time, but it's a good point about the upcoming elections. Reuters' Dave McKinney, the Associated Press's Sarah Burnett with me. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, fostering discovery by providing information curation and archival services to extend scholarly impact from Urbana-Champaign to the state, the nation, and the world. The University Library at Illinois.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's springtime. That means new life springing forth includes lots of baby bunnies that you may have seen or worried about, especially the baby bunnies. If their mothers aren't nearby, are they safe? Should you do something to help them? That's why in studio night right now with me is Ainsley Boyle. She's a second-year student at the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Illinois. She's also co-manager of the Wildlife Medical Clinic in Urbana, here to help answer these questions for us. Hi, Ainsley.
Hi.
Thanks for being here. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
So recently, I understand that you guys at the medical clinic have been inundated with healthy baby bunnies.
Yes.
And are people bringing them in because they think they're orphans?
Yes. So, you know, people find them in their backyard, whether they're, you know, mowing their lawns or their dog or a local outside cat brings it to their, you know, doorstep or something like that. And their first thought is, oh, well, it must be orphaned. The mom must not be around to, you know, take care of it anymore. So they think it's in danger, and that's usually how they end up coming to us.
So what comes to mind for me is that incident with the family with the bison in Yellowstone where they thought the bison had been orphaned, and mm-hmm. then they took the bison in their car, and then the bison ended up dying because, like, the mom didn't want it because it smelled like people.
Yeah.
Does the same thing happen with all animals, basically?
So, I mean, it's definitely possible that that can happen, but that's kind of an old wives' tale. You know, you hear if you touch a baby bunny and it has the human scent on it that the mom won't come back for it anymore. That's really not necessarily true. I mean, not to say that it never happens, but animals really do have a strong sense of smell, and so they're going to be able to smell that that's still their baby over whatever scent that we put on them if we happen to touch them or move them by accident.
Mm-hmm. So how do you know? How can you tell if a baby bunny is orphaned and when you actually should intervene?
Baby bunnies, if you find them in a burrow or a nest, you know, typically it's in a ground, under a bush, somewhere like that, they'll be nice and snuggled in, warm, you know, all huddled together. But if, you know, they're kind of popping out of their nest and their eyes are still closed, or you can see an obvious injury, you know, if a dog came and, you know, attacked them or something like that. Or another thing is if they seem cold and they're not, you know, all huddled, like I said before, that's kind of a good sign that mom isn't around and taking care of them anymore.
And do you know, I mean, in terms of like, should you just wait and kind of what's your advice for people? If the bunnies are not injured, is the best thing to just kind of leave them there and then see what happens in a little bit?
That is kind of what we tend to tell people, you know, give it a day, half a day to a whole day. Mama bunnies only come back to the nest twice a day, once at dawn and once at dusk, because they don't want the predators to, you know where the nest is and where the easy target of the babies are. So you're not going to see mom around at the nest. But, you know, if you notice in the morning you find a burrow of bunnies and they seem that they're maybe not doing too well, but they're still huddled together and seem comfortable, you can always, you know, come back and check on them that night or the following morning. And if they're still in that same situation, that's kind of a good sign that you may need to intervene and they need some help.
This conversation was inspired in part because there was a baby squirrel that was outside the station earlier, and there was a lot of concern from some people that this poor little baby squirrel was all by itself, and they said, we need to take it over to the College of Veterinary Medicine. Mm-hmm. What do you suggest with people do with all sort of baby animals that they find? Is there sort of a barometer for which animals you need to be more concerned about? Because I imagine for the Wildlife Medical Clinic, are people just dropping off little baby animals all the time to you guys?
Yeah, they definitely are. And, you know, once these babies, really any species, once their eyes are open and they seem aware of their surroundings, they're okay to be out on their own. I mean, it's case by case. It depends. And you can always call your local wildlife rehabilitator and they can give you advice on, you know, how to observe the animal, whether you need to step in.
And so rule of thumb, basically, if it's not injured, you should probably just leave it there.
If it's not injured, or if you know that there's a possibility that mom is still alive, you should just leave it there and let mom do her job, because she is way better at it than we are.
So I know you guys got like 20 bunnies in one, in basically a really short time period, mm-hmm. right? In a couple of hours. So what do you guys do with all these baby bunnies when they come to the clinic? What ends up happening to them?
Yeah, so I mean, we just, the first thing we do is we make sure that they're warm and healthy. And then basically we feed them. We actually tube feed them. And then as soon as we're able to transfer them out to a licensed wildlife rehabilitator, we try to get them out the door as soon as possible, because, you know, they have the facilities and the volunteers to do that, and they're kind of the experts.
Thanks so much for joining us. It's Ainsley Boyle. She's a second-year student at the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine, and she's the co-manager of the Wildlife Medical Clinic in Urbana. Thanks for being here, Ainsley.
Thank you so much for having me.
Astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson is arguably the coolest scientist out there these days. He's a prolific writer whose latest book is called Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. The director of New York City's Hayden Planetarium is in Illinois for an event tomorrow night at the Chicago Theater, but we have a chance to speak with him now. Hi, Neil. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Can we start this interview with the end of your book? Your last chapter includes a quotation by the 18th century Scottish astronomer James Ferguson, who said, astronomy is sublime. And I wanted to ask why you think that's the case.
Well, he thought it was the case. And that was, you know, hundreds of years ago, before even the modern discoveries that we celebrate were a twinkle in his eye. So sublime, I think we would use that word for knowledge or emotion or experience that transcends what goes on in your everyday life. And anyone who has thought about the universe and the things that go on there, the dangerous things, the beautiful things, the mind-blowing things, I think sublime is just the right word for it. And I think he put his finger on the button right there.
So all of the dangerous things, the beautiful things, all of these are in Astrophysics for a Hurry. This is probably a very typical occurrence for you, but I mentioned that I was interviewing you on Facebook and my feed completely blew up. You got two marriage proposals, even though I told them that you were married, a request for a
happily
hug.
Happily married, too. Yeah.
Happily married. Let's make that very clear. A request for a hug from someone in Chicago. Others were asking how is he the coolest guy in the room, the coolest geek in the room, which I think is pretty evidenced by this outpouring. But why did you decide to tackle tackle this topic, astrophysics in a hurry, for your latest book?
Actually, it's astrophysics for people in a hurry. Just to be clear, it has people in mind. What I noticed was that there are people who lead busy lives, overscheduled lives, but they did catch a snippet of a headline that wafted by. They saw exoplanet in a headline, or colliding black holes, or dark matter, dark energy, or even multiverse. You've seen these words, but you're not quite conversant in it. And I thought to myself, if I collected together these mind-blowing concepts that have been hitting the headlines of recent years and add some more of my choosing and create a story arc for it, that I could create a book that could completely serve the person who doesn't have time to sit down and commit to a huge volume or watch multiple series of a documentary. And so, and not only that, I, for the first time of the books I've written, I've decided to narrate the book for the audio version of it. So that if you're stuck in traffic, I'm with you, helping you out. And it's, the book is not long, and it's not even that expensive. I think it's like on Amazon, it's like $12. It retails for like $19. It's not going to set you back. And you can then have your moment where you can commune with the cosmos in a meaningful way. And then all of these bits and pieces that you've thought about separately come together in one coherent whole. And then you'll be fluent at the water cooler the next morning. That's my goal.
Right. And I will attest to the fact that it does not take a long time to read. I have a confession to make to you. I actually never took physics in high school or college because I was a philosophy and psychology major, and all of my graduate degrees are in the humanities. So when I read in your book about what I'll refer to as the hot cocoa nightcap incident, and I'll let you explain that
incident.
If you want.
To me, it was just another day, you know, on the job.
Okay. Well, I wonder how often people get in arguments with you about basic laws of physics.
Yeah, I think there's an old saying, if an argument lasts more than 5 minutes, then both sides are wrong. So, of course, that's not true in all cases. If you can explain why something is true in a way that the person can take ownership of it, then they don't have to refer back to you for its truth. They know it's true because they understand it. And so as an educator, I feel compelled in this way. So you wanted the coffee house incident. So I was in Pasadena, California, and in one of the corner coffee shops. And I don't really drink much coffee, but I like a hot chocolate every now and then. So I ordered hot chocolate with whipped cream, of course. Okay, so the hot chocolate comes to my table, and there's no whipped cream. And I call back the waiter, and I said, "You guys left off the whipped cream." And the waiter says, "Oh, it sank to the bottom." And I said, "Unless the laws of physics of the universe are different in your coffee shop, you did not put whipped cream on this coffee." And he says, "Yes, it did. I'll prove it to you." And so he goes in the kitchen, brings back the whipped cream container, takes a dollop, drops it into the hot chocolate, and it bobs once or twice and then floats there on the top. And so the good thing about it is, even though the server was indignant, the server thought to actually do the experiment. And so this incident did not drag on. It was over with in a matter of minutes, because of the experiment demonstrating what is true. Then I made it clear that heavy cream is lighter than skim milk. That's why cream rises to the top. And that's how you got skim milk in the first place. You skimmed off the heavy cream that floated to the top of the skim milk. Then you whip it, adding more air to it. Whipped cream is not sinking on anything by the time you're done. So he explained this, and then he's good. Now he doesn't. Now he can explain it to other people, and that's one little bit of science enlightenment entered into the world.
You also have, of course, lots more of scientific enlightenment in this. And I had, prior to this, never spent a lot of time thinking about what's between galaxies. But I'm wondering why you wrote that maybe what's between galaxies are actually more important to the evolution of the universe than maybe galaxies themselves.
We have an understandable bias that we think what exists are the things that our senses can detect and react to and experience. So we pull out our telescopes, we look out in space, and we see galaxies beyond our own galaxy. And we say, and galaxies are comprised of stars, and as is our galaxy. So you say, okay, so that must be what the universe is made of. But then you make other more subtle measurements, like where is the gravity? And you find out that the stars that are in galaxies comprise 15% of the gravity of the universe. And there's something else out there that's responsible for gravity. And we still don't know what that is. Meanwhile, the vacuum of space is responsible. There's a mysterious pressure in the vacuum of space that is forcing an acceleration of the expansion of the universe. We don't know what's causing that either, but we measure it. Not only that, there are dwarf galaxies and ejected stars and all manner of stuff, and that more sophisticated methods and tools of measurement revealed to us over the decades. So there's a whole chapter called Between the Galaxies as a reminder that just because it didn't meet your eye the first time you looked doesn't mean there's nothing there. And getting back just briefly to the hot chocolate incident, the reason why that story is retold in the book is because I'm conveying to the reader, there's a chapter called On Earth as It Is in the Heavens. And in that chapter, you learn how we came to know that the laws of physics we measure on Earth apply everywhere across the universe and across time. That was not an obvious fact. It could have been that Earth had its own little laws of physics, and then the moon had its own laws, and Jupiter and Saturn and other stars and other galaxies. There's nothing written in the sky that required that what we discover on Earth is the same everywhere, but it is. And that's what gives me the confidence that this person's coffee shop didn't have a different law of physics from what we measured, and that when we bring new methods and tools to decode the universe, that we are seeing the universe in a greater approximations of what it really is. So, yeah, there's stuff everywhere, and it's a reminder that there's more to the universe than meets the eye.
Well, and I think when you say that, what it reminds me of also is what you also talk about in the book about what we don't know about dark matter and dark energy, which you just alluded to. And you have a line in the book that completely freaked me out because you said in regards to dark matter, maybe there's nothing wrong with matter, and maybe it's gravity that we don't understand. And I wanted to ask you about how vexing is this problem of understanding dark matter.
It is the longest unsolved problem in science. We've had this problem since the 1930s, mid-30s was the discovery of this mysterious gravity. In fact, dark matter, we don't know that it's matter, so that word is a little misleading to newcomers to the field. We should just come up with a name that conjures no image at all of anything, because we have no idea what it is, even though we can measure it. So I just recommend we call it Fred. Or Wilma. Just something that...
By that measure, then, should we not use the term dark energy?
Well, so call that Wilma. We got Fred and Wilma, and we'll try to figure this out. Okay, yes, by that very same measure. So I try not to... when I say dark matter, well, could it be a kind of matter that people start posing questions? See, you're already biased, just because of the name we gave something we don't understand. So names matter. And so... So the point is, in this book, it's often you think of books are written about what we know. There's a lot we don't know, and there's chapters in there about stuff we don't know. And that's part of the mystery of the universe and what drives us to wake up each morning and run to the lab or run to the rocket launch pad and track the data of our telescopes and our space probes and our computer simulations and all of the exchanged ideas that goes on in workshops and conferences.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Neil deGrasse Tyson. His new book is called Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. He's going to be in Chicago tomorrow night for an event. We'll tweet out all that information, have it available at our website. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's an astrophysicist, a science communicator, a prolific writer whose latest book is called Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. The director of New York City's Hayden Planetarium is in Illinois for an event tomorrow night at the Chicago Theater. We are talking to him right now. Neil, you know, I've had a lot of conversations with scientists, especially in the realm of people doing research on genetically modified organisms. And they've talked about the lack of trust that they see among the general public. So it's not just a question of, say, conservatives denying climate change, but liberals hating GMOs. And I wanted to ask you, as a communicator, if you think scientists need to do things differently to combat the trend toward distrust of science and scientific inquiry.
It would be hard to say, okay, the public doesn't trust you, so now figure out another way to do science. That would be hard. It may be even impossible. Because we're doing science in the best ways we've figured out over the centuries, to the methods and tools of inquiry and how you publish it and how you communicate it. So first, let me follow up on a point that you only hinted to, that science denial is not the unique purview of the conservative right. There's plenty of science denial to go around on the liberal left. But the liberal left likes thinking it has the high ground in this, but it does not. Okay? Vaccine denial is... So science denial means you are denying emergent scientific truths. You're denying established science to hold these views. Okay? And that would include denying the role of vaccines in all that they are said to do. That leans left. Other things that lean left... Anti-GMO leans left. So does things like crystal healing and other sort of mystical medicines leans left. The entire field of alternative medicine leans left. I can go on, but my point is that means there's something missing in our educational background, K through 12, let's say. I think I know, but I haven't. I want to think more deeply for longer and then maybe write it up one day. But I think K through 12, we focus on pouring information into kids' heads and having them recite it back for exams. And if you get a high score on your exam, we say you are smart. But what about processing information? What about thinking about data and interpreting data and comparing data and assessing information and knowledge and judgment on what is going on? What about our capacity to do that? Because that's what goes on when you conduct science. So I think what we're missing is a course, multiple courses, on the methods and tools of science and the analysis of information. If we had that in K through 12, and we figured out a way not to beat your curiosity out of you that you have until third grade, maybe until sixth grade, but by middle school, I don't know if anybody's got any curiosity left at all. And you know this because you have kids running down the steps last day of school, say, school's out. They throw their notes pads in the air as though learning was the most stressful thing they ever did in their lives, when all they had to do was just learn. That's their only task. But somehow the experience of school squashed the curiosity that we should all maintain coming out of school, the curiosity we already had as young children. Young children risk their lives every day simply because of their own curiosity. Half the effort of a parent is preventing the kid from killing itself. Or don't you draw the line, I'll stop you from killing yourself, but I'll let you do pretty much everything else. You should have free-range kids so that maybe the curiosity stays deeply enough in them that they can carry it into adulthood. And if you were as curious as an adult as you were as a kid, we have a word for those folks. They're called scientists.
I'm speaking with astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. His latest book is called Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. And to that point, you also write that the periodic table of elements should be considered, quote, cultural icon. Why do you say that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it is one of the most brilliant organizations of knowledge that has ever come out of civilization. So first of all the, you look at this table, we remember it from high school chemistry if you didn't have it in college. There is chart, mysterious chart of boxes. This contains every element that comprises everything in the universe. Everything made of atoms can be found on this chart. So imagine a kitchen where you want to bake anything, and you just open the cabinet and every possible ingredient you want is there at your choosing. Well, this is the ultimate cabinet that you can ever dream up. And because elements were discovered by different countries at different times and they're given different names, depending on who made the discovery, it is a walking, talking record book. Not talking, just walking. Well, it's a standing record book. If someone is next to you reciting it, it's a walking, talking record of the history of discovery. For example, do you know we discovered an element on the sun before we discovered it on Earth? And we said, well, it's of the sun. What should we call it? Let's name it after the Greek god of the sun, Helios. And thus came the element helium. This is a fascinating bit of history. Well, for me, it's fascinating that our instruments are discovering things elsewhere in the galaxy, elsewhere in the solar system, before we found out what the thing was on Earth. Another one. At the end of the table, at the bottom of the table, where you have heavy elements, uranium, we all have heard of uranium. You know what that was named after? The planet Uranus. And you know what follows uranium on the periodic table? Neptunium. You know the planet just beyond Uranus? It's Neptune. It was named after Neptune was discovered. Guess what comes next on the periodic table? Plutonium. Guess whose plutonium is named after? Okay, plutonium was discovered in 1940, 10 years after the object formerly known as planet Pluto was discovered itself in 1930. And so Pluto now, of course, we all know, demoted from its planet, full up planet status. So Pluto got onto the periodic table on false pretense, I think. But we needn't go there.
I was going to say, I don't want to get you started on that.
Hold me back.
You know,
hold
Neil, the enthusiasm that you have when you're describing this, it was one thing I wanted to ask you about. You have a section in the book where you talk about the gravitational wave discovery. Last year, when we finally created technology capable of seeing gravitational waves, and we were able to see that when it washed over Earth. And I will confess that when this happened, I had long conversations with my producers about whether or not we should do this conversation. And I'm not quite sure I really even understood what was happening. And I did understand it when I read it in your book. And I wonder, how do you go about trying to explain complex things in a manner that you think people can understand? Do you just spend a lot of time talking to people who aren't scientists?
Okay, so truly complex things are just not in the book at all.
So you made it easy.
Okay.
Okay. It's still astrophysics. I'm telling you.
It's still completely astrophysics. There's, you know, someone joked, what was the title, Astrophysics for Dummies, already taken? No. This is astrophysics for people in a hurry, and it's real astrophysics. Okay. So, you know, batten down the hatches. But it's written in a way that I think you can, you know, a literate person can be carried through all of these ideas and concepts. I think you only think that there are ideas that are too complex, that are complex out there, but they're really not. They're simple, and it just takes some effort to figure out how to describe them in ways that are not complex. And it's not, doesn't mean dumbing something down. I don't think I've ever been accused of dumbing anything down. I use real language, and in my field, real language is fun. Black hole, quasar, Big
cosmic
Bang,
rays.
You know,
we haven't even talked
cosmic
about
rays. These are really cool vocabulary that does not set up a smokescreen so that we can get straight to the idea that matters here. Many other scientific professions have a level of precision in their lexicon, but that precision can cloud the ideas that we're trying to communicate as a scientific in the scientific fields. So my field, we just call it like we see it. And that makes it easier to talk about. Now, I'm disappointed you guys didn't do that story. I thought it was a great story that 1.3 billion years ago, two black holes collided in a galaxy far, far away. And that collision created a disturbance in the fabric of space and time that emanated from it moving at the speed of light. And it is this spherical ripple moving in every direction from this location of the colliding galaxies. 1.3 billion years ago, our ancestors in life were single-celled organisms trying to figure out how to become more complex. And as this wave continued to move from galaxy to galaxy, washing over all the galaxies in between, life continues to evolve on Earth. And then 65 million years ago, it crosses over another galaxy much closer to us now, but still 65 million years ago, we have dinosaurs on Earth. They go extinct, and mammals rise up and create a branch of itself called primates, a branch of which we call humans. And those humans develop civilization and technology, and we build an apparatus. And we learn from Albert Einstein, born in 1879, that there's such a thing as gravity waves, that there's such a thing as black holes. Oh my gosh, let's see if we can detect these. And we ask for funding from the National Science Foundation, and internationally we cooperate. And we build this instrument, turn on the switch, and right then, within days, it is 1.3 billion years after those two black holes.
This should be a movie, the way that you just
collided.
Described it. See, if I had you to explain this, we would have talked about this.
And this wave washes over Earth, and we detect it. That is what happened, and that's why it was banner headlines. And I'm very disappointed you guys didn't cover
that
story.
Well, the reason, mostly because we're an Illinois show, and we figured our friends at NPR would do a very good job of covering it nationally.
Oh, okay.
One last question for you, Neil, before we let you go. One of my producers said we were watching your rock star reception you got on the Colbert show lately. And she said, every geek wants to know, how does he make everything so cool? Do you have an answer for that?
Oh, no. I think the universe is inherently cool. And I'm just revealing that to you. That's all I'm doing. That's all it is. Black holes are cool. The thermonuclear fusion in the core of the sun is cool. Asteroid impacts are cool. Time travel is cool. Forward and backwards time travel, all cool. Spaceships, cool. Rotating space stations with docking space shuttles, cool. It's all cool. I'm simply your conduit to the cosmos.
I appreciate that. Do you think, is it an occupational hazard then when you read science fiction, for example, or you watch science fiction, like that you get irritated because it's not accurate? I feel that way if I watch TV shows or movies about journalism.
Oh, yeah.
Do you feel that way about shows like Firefly? Are you thinking, oh, this isn't right?
Okay, if they have the pretense of getting everything right, then I'm going to look for what they got wrong, and I might even tweet about it. And that's basically out of respect for the movie. But if a movie makes no attempt to get any science right, like Star Wars, it's not worth anybody. I'll just sit back and watch it. I tweeted about The Force Awakens, Star Wars 7, I guess that was. And people got angry. And I think my tweets are misunderstood at some level. I'm just trying to enhance.
No.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm just.
So how do you want everyone to think about your tweets?
That I want to enhance your movie-going insights. So that you say, oh, I didn't know that. Oh, I didn't think to think about that. Oh, my gosh, thanks for noticing that for me. I want to notice things that you might not have noticed because I'm an educator and I'm a scientist, and maybe I'll see stuff that you didn't. And if you did see it, just ignore the tweet. But if you didn't, then carry it with you. And so, but then so many people just, they got angry. Time magazine, time.com, banner headline said, how Neil deGrasse Tyson tried to destroy Star Wars The Force, how to completely ruin Star Wars The Force Awakens. I put out about 11 tweets. One of them was BB-8, a smooth rolling spherical metal sphere, would have skidded uncontrollably on sand. That's just a fact, okay? Now, you're going to be angry with me because I call this out? Or just, why not just accept it as a fact? So I don't know if I'll even do it anymore, post tweets on it.
Oh, no.
Yeah,
well, I feel like your millions of Twitter followers will be very disappointed.
Okay.
I say keep tweeting. I think the people of Illinois would agree with me. I want to thank you very
Illinois.
Much for
okay.
taking the time.
Excellent.
Yes, I'm speaking for all of Illinois, mm-hmm. all the public radio
Excellent.
Listeners anyway.
Thank you.
I do want to thank you. Neil deGrasse Tyson is going to be in Chicago tomorrow evening at the Chicago Theater. His latest book is called Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. Neil, it's been a pleasure.
And I've been to the Chicago Theater before. Very warm audience. I'll be delighted to return. Thank you.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us via phone, email, or social media, it's all at our website, 21stshow.org. If you follow us on Twitter, search for 21stshow. That's our handle. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montecilio, and Sean Newman. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft. Engineering help also from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.